Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is June 18, 2021, early Friday morning here in Nashville. Predictions are that it's going to be a very hot day with increasing humidity. Well, that's June in Nashville. Thanks, as always, to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our intro music. Several weeks ago, Beth and I attended an annual plant sale conducted by the Friends of Cedars of Lebanon State Park. If you are a gardener and a native plant enthusiast, this is definitely something you will want to put on your calendar. The Friends organization there at Cedars is very active. Each year, the volunteers propagate and grow enough native plants to fill the group meeting shelter. Everything from native grasses to popular perennial wildflowers in great abundance. And the prices are much less expensive than you might otherwise find at a garden center. The proceeds go to support the various projects that the Friends of Cedars of Lebanon State Park undertake. And be sure to check out the Native Plant Garden, which is adjacent to the Nature Center at the park, if you visit Cedars. In any case, while browsing through the native plants at the plant sale, I happened to run into an old friend, Reggie Reeves. Reggie and I had worked together many years ago at the Tennessee Department of Conservation. As it turns out, Reggie and I share a passion for gardening with native plants, which we never would have known about 30 years ago when we worked together. Reggie is a dedicated and ambitious gardener and is now a certified master gardener, involved in the training and education of other gardeners. And so I thought it would be fun to get together with Reggie to talk about his outstanding career as a conservationist, a journeyman park ranger, park manager, and ultimately director of Division of Natural Areas for Tennessee, and about his enthusiasm for gardening. After a year of isolation on account of the pandemic, it was great fun to have Reggie here at the house, do a garden tour, and record the first live in-person interview in a long time. And so I hope you'll enjoy this interview with my old friend Reggie Reeves. So, Reggie Reeves, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you here. I think it's going to be a fun conversation. I should say for the audience that this is the first time that we've done the audio, the podcast recording in person, live and in person with our guests in the last 18 months or so since the pandemic. So, I'm proud to have you here as our first in-person guest.
Proud to be here as your guinea pig.
As we get back into the swing of things. And you're correct to say guinea pig because there's some skills involved in this in the recording here, so we'll see how we do. Reggie, you and I share a common experience that I treasure in my life, the time that I spent working at conservation, and I know you spent a longer time working there. I can remember my first recollection of meeting you was you were assigned to Long Hunter State Park.
Yes.
And I was still working in the Division of Planning and Development. For some reason, we went out to Long Hunter for an event or something, and it may have been the launching of that trail around Couchville Lake.
Might have been, or the beginning of some of the development that we did there, the Vista Center, the fishing pier.
Well, it may have been the fishing pier because that trail, because yes, that was one of the very first handicapped accessible mm-hmm. Facilities that we ever did, really, in the Tennessee State Parks, which is amazing. This was like 1981 or 82, something like that.
Yes, and I believe that was a 2-mile paved trail around Couchville Lake.
Right. So that's the first time I remember meeting you or even knowing about you. And I remember also that for some reason or another, TVA had provided the plans for a passive solar house that was being used as a Rangers residence.
Yes.
Were you living in that house at that time?
I wasn't in that house. I never did live in that house.
Okay.
I lived
okay.
on the other side of the park in another home.
Okay.
But that was developed along with the Vista Center, the fishing pier, the 2 mile trail around the lake. So, yeah.
Well, that was really a cool house. And so if you ever go out to Longhorn, folks, it just looks like kind of a modern house,
mm-hmm.
But it's designed to be to incorporate this passive solar for heating and cooling.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah. So Reggie, tell us about in your life. You've chosen a career in parks conservation. What was your inspiration to get into that career?
You know, I guess it goes back maybe. I grew up in South Alabama, or LA as we called it. You know, LA.
Lower Alabama,
not Los Angeles. and grew up with my dad hunting and fishing and spending a lot of time outdoors. We always had extensive woods behind our houses that we lived in as I was growing up. Spent time as a kid playing in those. Just a lot of time outdoors with my dad, really, I think, put a pretty firm foundation down for something related to working in the outdoors in some capacity.
Okay.
So I went to MTSU, started off studying aerospace. I got my pilot's license when I was, and I forget, whatever the youngest age you can get a pilot license is, maybe 18, and I got my pilot's license.
I had no idea.
And was, you know, spent time flying around a good bit and was considering commercial aviation as a career. And it's been a long time. For whatever reason, I decided that wasn't a pursuit that I wanted. That's what I was studying at MTSU. And I discovered a program in the Geography Earth Science Department that was Geography Earth Science degree with a park service emphasis. And I thought that sounded pretty cool. So at any rate, I switched over to that as my major, graduated MTSU, got a seasonal interpretive job at Hiawassee State Scenic River.
Oh my goodness.
That was my first gig with state parks. And it was their first seasonal naturalist.
Okay.
So I learned from people like Richard Hilton and Charlie Tate and Bobby Fulcher, you know, how to be a seasonal naturalist. Jeff Whitehead was the park manager then.
Sure.
And spent a glorious summer there on the Hiawassee State Scenic River. I really enjoy myself and providing educational and interpretive activities for campers and visitors. Well, anyway, that was during the summer. That ended and went back to school in the fall semester at MTSU. And I found out that they were going to have a park ranger opening at Hiawassee State Scenic River. That obviously piqued my interest. And then I got a phone call and said, yes, would you like to apply for this position? We're going to have it. And I applied. Make a long story short, I was fortunate to get that position as a park ranger at Hiawassee State Scenic River. The downside was that I had to make a tough decision. I was in graduate school at that time at MTSU and actually had a graduate teaching assistantship. And so I'm sitting there thinking, well, I've got, you know, another year of school left, another couple of semesters of graduate teaching assistantships, and who knows what might happen after that.
Right.
Or I've got a job offer with state parks. So I made the very difficult decision to withdraw from graduate school, give up my GTA, and become a park ranger at Longhorn State Park. And it was a tough, tough decision to make at the time. Turned out to be one of the best decisions ever made because it launched a career that I stayed in for over 30 years. Enjoyed several years at the Hiawassee River as a scenic, as a park ranger. Really cool experience with a Ford Bronco with a blue hole canoe tied on top. You know, driving the Forest Service roads and up and down the river and working with visitors, occasional rescues, the administrative stuff that goes with it. Spent, I guess, maybe 3 years there or so. And then there was an opportunity to transfer to Radnor Lake State Natural Area.
Okay.
And I was basically from Murfreesboro since high school and thought it would be nice to get back home, near home, spend some time in a different kind of a park environment, state natural area, in the middle of Davidson County.
When would that have been that you transferred up?
78, 79, 80, probably around the early 80s.
Okay. All right. That's pretty early in the history of that park.
Yeah, it was. Jeff Sinks was the park manager at the time.
Exactly.
I spent several years there. And then you mentioned Longhorn State Park earlier. I was given an opportunity to transfer to Longhorn State Park as the park manager.
Right.
And took that opportunity, obviously, and spent about 10 years there. I loved that very much. Was able to steer the development of that park through its Vista Center, more hiking trails, backcountry trails, the fishing pier, the 2 mile barrier-free trail we talked about.
So you were the first park manager?
No, I wasn't.
No, I wasn't.
I believe Thurman Mullins was there before me, the great Thurman Mullins. If I remember correctly, I had to follow in his footsteps, and that was the quite large shoes to fill. Thurman's a legend.
Thurman was the seasoned guy at that point in time. I mean, he had been 20 years or more into the Park Service by that time.
So. He also went on to become the horse trainer and horse trader for Charlie Daniels.
Sure, closely associated with Charlie Daniels. Yeah. Right.
But at any rate, spent 10 years there at Longhunter State, roughly, State Park, and really enjoyed that. Met a lot of nice people, a lot of nice staff, got a lot of good experience in the broader administrative side of park management. And then there was an opportunity to go to our central office, which at that time was on West End Avenue, not far from here, overlooking Centennial Park. And I became, that was actually after the move. It was in the LNC Tower at that time. I just see you're frowning, you were right.
Yeah,
that was actually the LNC Tower. But anyway, I was able to become the director of the Division of Natural Heritage,
right,
which was an absolutely fascinating 10 years to spend.
So for our listeners that may not be familiar with the nomenclature there, the Division of Natural Heritage, what can you tell our audience about how that came to be and what its function was?
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting and fascinating program. Most every state has what's called a Natural Heritage Inventory Program. That was launched and developed by the Nature Conservancy.
Exactly.
And they ran some of those programs in many states for a period of time. And they began to see the need to separate the Natural Heritage Inventory Program sort of administratively from the Nature Conservancy's broader mission. The Natural Heritage Inventory Programs go about the business of identifying and cataloging locations of rare plant and animal species, assessing their overall status, their health, as well as rare natural communities. And so over a period of time, most every state, I believe, has a Natural Heritage Inventory Program. Some are within state universities, some are within branches of state government, and others are in other arrangements, maybe some still with the Nature Conservancy. I'm not sure about that today.
I can remember when the Nature Conservancy handed that program over to the state of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, Day Lohman was the head of the Nature Conservancy for Tennessee. And maybe Sam Pearsall?
Was the first director
of that?
I couldn't tell you that off the top of my head now, but he was involved.
Right.
My tenure there was after it had already been spun off and pretty well established within state government.
I think Dan Eager had been in front of you in that job.
Right. Dan Eager was my predecessor.
Right.
And I followed in some more great shoes. Had to follow his act.
So tell us in more detail what that division does. And you talk about an inventory, but give us some details about it.
Well, basically, the Nature Conservancy had developed a database. At that time, it was called the Biological Conservation Database, or BCD. I believe it's evolved on now to other nomenclature, but still does the same thing. Basically, it works with the staff within the Natural Heritage Inventory Program, which is a unit of state government that I was a director of for a while. Also, data from other researchers, independent researchers, private citizens, other university researchers, other federal and state agency researchers, land managers, to try to catalog across the state known locations of rare plant and animal species and rare natural communities. And not only just to catalog their location, but also to assess their overall status, their health, and in turn drive conservation needs. So that database would have, you could look up any one given rare plant or any suite of rare plants, any collection of rare plants or rare communities, look at their distribution across the state, look at how secure those distributions are or aren't, and then take measures to protect those of highest priority.
You know, one of the things I remember about that was that in the early days, at least, and I'm sure it became more sophisticated later on, the database was basically essentially a collection of USGS quad sheets upon which were physically notated the right. location of, you know, the Tennessee coneflower or exactly. whatever the species was.
Statewide.
And yeah. When the Department of Transportation or some agency was proposing a project, you know, and they would define, you know, the road's going to go here, we were, as a department, able to look at those maps and say, mm-hmm. well, no, you need to move the road 800 yards north, because if you don't, you're going to impact this crayfish that does.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
That may exist there. So it functionally it became a set of maps, which sounds to me like that would be right along your background.
Yeah,
from the training that you got at MTSU.
Sure, it was.
Ralph Fullerton.
Dr. Fullerton
was
yeah.
the head of that situation up there. I remember.
Exactly. How about that?
And well, it's interesting because the keeping of information about the occurrence of land patterns and disbursements of species and all that mm-hmm. on maps like that was at first, you know, just a mechanical thing you did. Mm-hmm. You did, but now it's all computerized.
Oh yeah, it has been for some time. Very user-friendly computerization now with GIS came along, obviously, and things were transformed to that
right.
format.
And the center that does that is located at MTSU and is called the Ralph Fullerton
yeah.
GIS Center. I don't know whether Ralph is even still alive, but
he is.
Is he? Okay, yeah. But certainly that facility there was named in his honor.
Played a key role.
One of our early guests on this program actually runs that program, Zeta Law.
Don't know Zeta.
Okay, well, Zeta is an archaeologist by training. And, of course, that's among one of the things that they track mm-hmm. is the cultural resources, so mm-hmm. to speak. But Zeta was one of our guests early on in this program talking about Fort Negley. Because mm-hmm. She had done a special study there, but coincidentally, she heads up the Ralph Fullerton
wow,
program.
How about that?
So yeah, it's interesting to tie all these things together. So, tell us were there any highlights in that job? Anything special that was discovered or?
I think what I took away from it mostly when I retired, and by the way, Roger McCoy is now the director
okay.
and is doing a fabulous job.
Okay.
He's taking what I did and the staff that was with us at that time into a whole other level. And the entire staff there are absolutely incredible. The biologist, zoologist, ecologist, the botanist there, just an absolutely incredible staff.
I'm certain that they are, and I guess I need to meet some of them.
I
must tell you that they've been pretty incredible all along. Paul Summers as mm-hmm. a botanist, I mean, he taught me so many things. I'm ashamed to say he had to teach me because
yeah.
I was ignorant of many things and learned a great deal from him. And Dan Eager and all those people were first class biologists.
Yeah, Paul Summers was there when I got there
right.
as the new director and obviously learned a lot from him.
Right.
A very accomplished botanist.
Botanist.
Just incredible.
Yeah, I guess Paul was led the charge for getting the Tennessee coneflower listed, recognized as its mm-hmm. own species separate from the Echinacea mm-hmm. generally, but then getting it listed on the list of rare and endangered plants and animals.
Yeah, and I believe it was the first plant listed as a federally endangered plant.
Well, I didn't know that. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So you were there in the Heritage Program for many years. Then you moved over to the State Natural Areas Program.
Well, they're together. The Natural Heritage Inventory Program was a division when I took the job there.
Okay.
With a staff that ran the Heritage Inventory Program itself,
okay.
but also the State Natural Areas Program
okay.
and the Environmental Review Component. And the Environmental Review Component is that part you touched on earlier where any kind of development that's going on, particularly federally or state-funded development or development on public lands, can be compared, the location can be compared against that database of known rare plant and animal species, again, as you touched on,
right.
to make sure that we're not adversely impacting something. If we are, how do we mitigate that? So that was a part of the division. But yeah, I was there. The Division of Natural Heritage was the name of the division. And after some time there, I realized that most people outside of people that really worked with natural heritage programs or neighboring state or federal agencies or the Nature Conservancy, but the general layperson didn't really know what that was, what it meant.
Right.
And you would say you were with the Division of Natural Heritage, and here we are. And they would say, well, what is that and what do you do? Because it's not clear in the name.
Right.
And after some time, you know, so much of public support is for an agency or for an entity is built around how much people understand what you do and who you are.
Right.
And I thought that rather than continually trying to explain to people what the Division of Natural Heritage is, we also had within our division a program called the Natural Areas Program. And that's something that almost everybody's familiar with in some capacity. So after some discussion with staff and higher-ups in the department, we decided to change the name of the division, but not the structure, just to put front and center the Natural Areas Program, which everyone understood.
I got it.
So we could say, we are with the state of Tennessee's Natural Areas Program, and everyone understands that. The structure and function stayed the same.
Let's explore that a little bit, because I think the structure has changed a little bit since I was involved, and I want to get into that, but this year is the 50th anniversary of the Natural Areas Program.
Natural Areas Act.
I should say. As I was about to say, it was an act established by the legislature, right, and at first named, you know, 30 or 40, but I can't remember the number of places that were designated as natural areas. Tell us more about that.
Well, that preceded me by a good bit,
right.
50 years ago.
Right.
And that's just, you know, I wish I had been there then. But we recently celebrated that act, the 50th anniversary at Red Deer Lake. The governor was there. Several other important people that were part of that act. Bill Bruce was there. Trying to think of who else might have been there. There was a pretty large turnout of people there on the overlook at Red Deer Lake.
Right.
Just celebrating the establishment of that act 50 years ago and looking at 50 years in the future. So yeah, that was this is 50 years of celebrating 50 years of conservation.
And so the natural areas, being a natural area doesn't necessarily mean it's a state-owned property.
Right, and that is a unique component of the act itself. A state natural area may be state-owned and state-operated and managed by the division as a state natural area. It might also be a part of embedded within an adjacent state forest or a state wildlife management area.
Right.
It could be on federal land, it could be on private land. But all in all, it uses the science behind the Natural Heritage Inventory Program to prioritize areas worthy of conservation. You know, there's a lot more that we would like to conserve than the dollars will let us conserve, or the time and effort is there to do. There's a tremendous amount of work to do related to conservation of rare species and their habitats across the state.
Right.
So you have to narrow that down to pretty fine targets,
right,
that get you the most bang for the buck, delivers the most conservation for the dollar and for the effort. And so those places might be on private property. And in some cases, a conservation easement can be transferred onto the property by the property owner that can allow that conservation easement to provide perpetual protection. Or in other cases, it may be another instrument, which is just a registered state natural area, which is not designated under state law, but is recognized through a voluntary agreement with a private landowner or even another agency landowner.
Yeah, we have some local governments that actually have
that
are the owners and caretakers of the state natural area.
Yeah, all over the state there are state natural areas, both designated and registered, across the state on federal land, state land, private land, university properties. It's a pretty broad spectrum of the kinds of properties. But the one thing they all have in common is that they do house populations, imperiled populations, of rare plant and animal species and or rare natural communities.
Right. You know, back in the day when there were just a few state natural areas designated or whatever, you know, some of them that were actually owned by the state were in the custody of the Division of State Parks.
Sure.
Okay. So Radnor Lake State Natural Area State Park is an example. So the Division of State Parks that operates the 53 or 56 state parks would have the charge of shepherding these little areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the classic example would be, a 20-acre site of land that was 15 miles from Montgomery Bell or whatever, and the parks ranger would have to go out there once a week to check it out and make sure it was okay. Do I understand it correctly that the natural areas now have their own division? They don't necessarily rely on the Division of State Parks anymore. They're kind of a parallel thing.
It is a freestanding division.
Okay.
It is.
Okay.
But works very much through partnerships with other agencies.
Okay.
There are way more state natural areas actually designated, and I don't even have the number now because quite a few were just added under this year's legislation. But no, the Division of Natural Areas does not manage all of those.
Right.
Many are managed through cooperative partnerships with state parks,
right,
with state forests,
right,
with the Army Corps of Engineers, with industrial forest lands even, private property, as we touched on earlier.
Okay.
So, but those that are managed and owned by the State Natural Areas Program, those are the ones they spend most of their time and effort managing, looking after, in some cases, providing public access. State natural areas aren't really driven by public access like a state park would be.
Right.
But there are times and places where public access is an appropriate mechanism to let the public get into and understand and see these places.
Got you. Some are so fragile that you don't want the public there.
Right. There are some that are so sensitive, either from people trampling on populations of rare plant species or even stealing them or pirating them.
Right.
Some places and sometimes that location is not, we don't provide, the Natural Areas Program doesn't provide public access to all places.
One of the early ones that I recall was May Prairie.
Beautiful place.
Yeah. I've been there just once, but the public, if the public wants to see it, the public can, but they have to make special arrangements so.
There is a trailhead there with a trail that will get you to part of it.
Right.
That's one, and it really, I would encourage listeners, any state natural area they're interested in seeing that doesn't have a designated parking area open to the public with a designated trail, just contact the Division of State Natural Areas and tell them you're interested in seeing that, what are the opportunities. I know they're often giving guided hikes to some of these places. Under certain circumstances, someone might could meet staff there to look at a place. But
just so we're clear, May Prairie, as I recall, is just right next to Manchester, Tennessee. Is that
it? Is
right along
a highway.
All right, and it's a remnant prairie.
Remnant prairie,
Which is so interesting because there's been so much work being done recently on on prairies and grasslands, I remember hearing about that and thinking that was such an odd thing, but probably it shouldn't have been such an odd thing.
should be a lot more native prairie and grasslands around than there are being at settlement and even after settlement. There were often places that were devoid of trees, tall grasses, wildflowers, but also places that made great pastures or great places to build things. So we lost most of our native remnant prairies in this part of the country to development. From pre-settlement on.
Right. Agriculture.
Agriculture primarily, but also just, building homes, highways.
Sure.
So, yeah. Sure. So now, more often than not, you'll find little vestiges of prairies alongside railroad right-of-ways, alongside highways sometimes, but you don't find very many large prairies. And Bay Prairie is a good example.
Right.
I know the staff there continues to manage that and look after it. They used historical photography to try to determine as best they could back as far in time as they could go, the original footprint as close as they could go back in time to the oldest photography they could find, and have been working on restoring May Prairie back at least to that original footprint documented by aerial photography from many years ago.
Tell us more now. I think what you're referring to is the fact that there may have been a larger footprint of a prairie, but that over time, natural succession occurs, and in other words, the woody plants and
trees
that sort
and
of
shrubs,
stuff, invade it.
Right.
And so they're going back now and trying to clear some of the cedar trees that may have popped up, and to bring the prairie back to its former size.
Yeah, we're back as close to it as can be documented.
Right.
Yes.
So, all right. So you were the head of the Natural Areas Program, or the Heritage Program, for several years. Is that, did you retire in that after?
I did. Okay. I was there for about, 10, 11, 12 years.
Okay.
Enjoyed it very much. And they're still carrying on the work. Like I said earlier, Roger McCoy is the director now. They've got a tremendous staff of biologists and ecologists, and continue the work today.
You know, during your time there, the state, it may have been just right at the time that you began in that job, that the state legislature created a program whereby the acquisition of these properties was funded.
Mm-hmm.
Not just for natural areas, but for parks generally.
Parks, forests, yeah.
So were your staff there responsible for kind of keeping a priority list of what needed to be acquired, and what would be the best spending of the money? Tell us about that.
Well, exactly. Using the science of the database we talked about earlier, which went from manually plotting points on topographical maps to announced in geographical information services, electronic databases. But the idea is to constantly evaluate the distribution and health of various populations of rare plants and animals and natural communities, determine which of those at any given time might be the highest priority for conservation. So there might be a list of however many high priority sites that may or may not be available for protection, but they're there.
Right.
So when the opportunity arises, you've got that list to go back to and say, hey, this is one of our priority sites. It looks like it might be available for protection by some means, be it acquisition, be it a conservation easement, or be it an agreement with the property owner. Mm-hmm. So yes, you touched on the funding mechanism. There's a funding mechanism that was established that lets TWRA, Division of Forestry, state parks, state historic sites, and state natural areas all participate in that.
Right.
And so each division has the responsibility of floating to the top within its division its highest priorities.
Right.
And when an acquisition opportunity comes along, that division brings that property to a larger committee. When I retired, it was called the State Land Acquisition Fund, or State Land Acquisition Committee, and I believe it still is. So you would have five or six divisions there, each floating up their best prospects that might be available for protection. And then within that compiled list from five or six different entities, decisions had to be made.
Sure.
With limited dollars as to which ones were the most important at that particular time.
Right.
So yeah, it's a process filtering sites through a division and to that larger committee, and then out of that committee, and then proposing those for acquisition.
Right. Well, I was in at the very first part of that when that was created, and it's an exciting thing. I was involved in it before the funding mechanism had been established, because there was always some budget for those kinds of acquisitions. But I'm sure that as the budget grew, that became a real lively committee.
It did, and there was always more conservation needs than there are dollars. And there are always hard decisions that had to be made about, which project received funding and which didn't. And, we always felt bad, about the projects that didn't quite make the cut, because they're all important. But, you have to cherry pick the most important at that given time with the resources and the funds you've got.
Let me pick your brain about something and share a recollection with you.
Okay.
The fellow that was the director of state parks for most of the time that I worked in that agency was Don Sharpio.
Remember Don well.
Right. And one of the things that Don recognized, and I talked with him about it, was the limited capacity that the division had in those days of scientists that actually worked in the division. So we were responsible for managing hundreds of thousands of acres of important land with people that had very limited training in biology or botany or water quality or geology or anything, or archaeology or anything. And I remember him bringing Linda Dries into the agency. I know you're shaking your head yes, and I'm sure you remember Linda. And her trying to guide the process of each park developing its resource management plan. Tell us about how the parks stand now relative to then.
I don't know if I can tell you as much about how the parks, Division of State Parks, stands.
Okay.
Probably similar to what we did in the natural areas
division. Okay.
You know, you've got existing natural areas and existing parks, forests, archaeological sites, what have you. I believe that most all of them probably have developed an acquisition plan, so to speak. You know, in a perfect world, what would that natural area, that archaeological site, that state historic site, whatever it is, what would it look like in a perfect world?
Right.
What would its boundaries be?
Right.
You know, what are the key boundaries to preserve what you're after, what you're trying to protect? And within that polygon that defines that ideally preserved site, there are multiple tracks.
Right.
And different tracks may or may not become available at different times, but you've got to be ready to know what your priorities are when a tract of land becomes available.
All right, let me rephrase my question. Because when you and I were involved, many of the park managers had very limited education and training. Today is a different story.
Yeah.
I think most of your rangers and leadership in the division are college educated, many with science degrees. Talk about how that shows itself on the ground with the decisions that they're making on a day-to-day basis in the parks.
Well, it's definitely a more informed decision. As the qualifications have been tightened up, as the requirements for experience have been tightened up, you get people, as you touched on, that are in a better position to make science-based decisions on how they manage the resource and to use more science in managing the resource. And so, you know, maybe it's not quite, you know, in the old days, parks was all about public visitation primarily, providing access for the public to facilities, trails, parking areas, restrooms, and the resource was there and was looked after and protected, but not necessarily with such a high degree of science as is now applied.
Right.
So now you've still got the visitor resources to take care of and to provide for, but you've also got much more informed decisions going on about how that resource is managed.
Right.
And opportunities for restoration. It's a lot more complex, a lot more informed decision about land management, resource stewardship today than it was, say, many years ago.
Well put, thank you. You know, one of the things that you and I share is an interest in the invasive exotic plants.
Yeah.
And I see that the staff in the parks now is, I mean, in the old days, they would not recognize, they wouldn't know what that was. Today, it's a completely different story.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's a big problem. Managing invasive species here in Davidson County, you know, close to where we are right now, most every public land in Davidson County is going to have a large population of shrub honeysuckle, which is not native. It's very invasive. Japanese honeysuckle. And trying to manage just those species, just the shrub honeysuckle alone, trying to get that out of a resource and keep it out is nearly impossible. It's a very, very difficult and complex task.
You know, you talked about having worked at Radnor in the early days, and I can remember walking Radnor, you know, in the late 70s, and it just was overrun with honeysuckle and privet hedge. Have you walked the trails out there recently?
I have. Steve Ward and his staff and with other resources have done an incredible job of really, I think their primary focus has probably been the shrub honeysuckle.
Right.
But there are places you can walk a trail and you may not see hardly any shrub honeysuckle. That allows the native vegetation to come back. the native wildlife to come back. But it is a monumental task, and they would know as well as anyone how difficult it is trying to eradicate invasive species from public land, and then once you get them out, keeping them out, or at least to a part of that public land. It's an incredible task.
So let's use that as switch point in this interview and talk about what you're doing in your retirement. And I know that one of the things that you're fascinated with is gardening.
Sure.
And I have seen, and the audience may want to find, go to YouTube and just search for Reggie Reeves.
Uh-oh.
And you will see a couple of nicely done presentations that you did on organic gardening. Mm-hmm. You did them with the Master Gardeners group in Rutherford County. Tell us about your interest in gardening and what you're doing.
Well, after I retired, I was kind of fumbling around looking for things to fill my time, because when you retire, you suddenly have 40 hours a week plus of free time. And that's pretty nice. That's a real luxury, and it's something we all work hard for. And when that time comes, it's a wonderful thing. But you've got to find some new points of interest, perhaps. And I noticed in the paper in Murfreesboro, where I lived, a class offered by the Master Gardener Program and Ag Extension on grounds management, lawn turf grass management for your lawn. So I signed up and took that. I enjoyed it a lot. I learned about other classes they had. Took a couple of more classes at the Ag Extension office. And then I learned about the Master Gardener Program, which is just a fascinating thing. I would encourage anyone who has any interest in gardening, and let's say gardening all the way from growing vegetables to growing roses, you know, from growing flowers to growing switchgrass, to growing turf. If you like gardening, the Master Gardener Program is a wonderful, wonderful thing to get into. Every county pretty much has one. It's run by the Ag Extension office in that county. It's overseen, administered by UT Extension Service. Mm-hmm. And basically they train an army of volunteers to help them deliver horticultural services to the private sector, just neighbors, people, individual citizens. And that way Ag Extension can spend more of their time dealing with producers, people doing this for a living. So you go through a 40-hour training course. It's pretty intensive. It'll cover everything you ever thought you might want to know and things you didn't know about horticultural activities. There's also a pretty heavy component of community outreach, the volunteer activities. It's a volunteer-based organization. And once you satisfy your community service requirements and your 40-hour training requirement that they put on for you, then you're certified as a Master Gardener. And then you're also certified under Ag Extension to provide horticultural services to the public. Each state, each county has an organization. Each county's organization meets usually once a month. And we also have to maintain, I believe it's 8 hours of CEUs every year.
Okay, continuing education.
Continuing education credits every year, and a certain number of hours of volunteer services every year. And so I learned, I was exposed to so many things through that training and to the people I met through that training, and sort of developed a real interest in gardening and especially organic approaches to gardening. And so that kind of became my passion and my post conservation years after 32 years in with TDEC, organic gardening and trying to educate people about organic gardening and learn more about organic gardening principles and practices, and also sustainable gardening, doing things in a sustainable way. And I developed some classes that I teach there in Rutherford County on organic and sustainable gardening. That's a lot of fun. I usually learn about as much as I try to teach people about. Very interactive classes with the classes giving back, and I feel like I've picked up a lot of additional knowledge from other people who were in the classes.
Well, so, it's fun because you and I reconnected because of that.
We did. Yeah. We did, and that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I ran into you a couple years ago at the Nashville Lawn and Garden Show.
Exactly, like minds.
And yes, because we wanted to both see Bree Arthur make her presentation, mm-hmm. and she was talking about incorporating grains and other food crops within your ornamental garden, which was fascinating. She was a terrific speaker. And then just a couple weeks ago, I saw you out at Cedars of Lebanon at the Native Plant Sale.
Exactly.
So that's how we reconnected for this. So what's happening in your garden right now?
Well, we've got 4 acres. We built a home there about 2008, I believe it was. And it was a blank slate. It was a clean slate when we showed up. My wife found the lot, had a tree line bisecting it, hackberry trees, shrubs, old fence row. 2 acres of the property had been a cornfield for a long time. The front part of the property had been bush hogged, basically, as a large open field. So we bought the lot, built a house, and standing there with 4 acres of basically a clean slate. And over the years, I've taken everything from the street in front of the house to our backyard, essentially, almost 2 acres, which comprises our yard, the driveway, the flower beds, various other plantings, a garden site, orchard. I've got peach trees, fruit trees, apple trees.
Oh, my goodness.
Plum trees, pear trees. We've got muscadines. I've made wine a few years. That's been a lot of fun, learning experience. And like you, Mark, I really put an emphasis on native plants and animal species.
Right.
Trying to draw native animals, native, particularly pollinators, by using native plants. Native wildflowers, native shrubs, native trees. I've planted hundreds of trees and shrubs on the property. And then the back half of the property, the back 2 acres, which was basically just a grown-up field when we bought the property, I've been trying to convert that to sort of a mixed grass prairie. I'm working with an organization called Invasive Plant Control.
IPC. Oh yeah.
They're real good guys. They do invasive plant control work really all over the country.
Right.
And they've been able to carve out a little time for me, once or twice a year, to try to treat the 2 acres, to try to eradicate things like Johnson grass, Japanese honeysuckle,
okay.
Poison ivy, which is a native plant, but it's a bothersome native plant. Bermuda grass and fescue, which none of which are really good wildlife benefit plants.
Right.
Most of which are not native. So far we've taken out pretty much all the Johnson grass with chemical applications of sure. the correct chemical at the right time. And I do everything I do on our property is organic approach, with the exception of occasionally a little bit of Roundup to treat Bermuda grass,
right.
because I hate Bermuda grass, and sometimes you just have to.
Well, and it's not a native species.
It's not, and right. it's difficult to manage otherwise.
Right.
But the field, conversion of a field to either recreate or establish a prairie, does take the application of certain chemicals. Same things that are used by the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, et cetera, Nature Conservancy, for trying to create, establish, and maintain prairies. So we've done several chemical applications. We got rid of the Bermuda grass. We got rid of the, in the field. We got rid of the fescue. We got rid of the Japanese honeysuckle. Much of the Johnson grass is gone. But what I've discovered, much to my horror, is in the absence of those things, the poison ivy has gone wild.
Oh.
So the poison ivy looked up and said, wow, no competition. Let's take over. And it has.
No kidding.
That's a native plant now, so we're going to try to time a chemical application in early to late fall, when most of what I'm managing for has become dormant after a couple of good frost, but before the Japanese honey, the poison ivy goes dormant. So that's going to be a task. I need to get that out. But along with all of the treatment that we're doing to get rid of invasive species, and to try to get rid of the poison ivy, planting various native warm season grasses,
okay.
and native wildflowers. And these are seed mixes I get from various producers of seed mixes
right.
for ecological restoration purposes across the country.
Right.
And we're beginning to have some success with getting things that we want. Some of the little blue stem planted side oats, grandma, some big blue stem. And a suite of native prairie, you know, wildflowers.
Wildflowers, Rudbeckia, and those.
It's a slow process.
Right.
It's coming. And we're using a product for a summer application called Plateau. And it's an herbicide. It's an interesting herbicide, and I can't tell you how it works. But it does control Johnson grass, controls fescue, It controls a number of broadleaf weeds, but it does not affect a broad suite of native warm season grasses.
Interesting.
And native wildflowers. So because of that, some of the seed companies that produce seeds for restoration across the country are selling what they call a plateau-tolerant seed mix. So it's a seed mix of those native warm season grasses and those native flowering plants that are tolerant of plateau, of the chemical application of plateau. And
that
way you can spray over. Yeah, you can spray a field with those species growing in it at the right ounces per acre at the right time and start to control some of the invasive things you don't want, but at the same time not adversely impact those plateau tolerant species.
That's fascinating. I was not aware that was going on.
It's interesting how it works. And then during as I mentioned earlier, in late fall, early winter, after probably two or three good frost, most of the things that I'm trying to protect are going to be dormant.
Right.
The frost will have knocked them back, but some of the things that we don't want are still going to be there, like Japanese honeysuckle.
Right, they're active, so, and so they can be sprayed.
Yeah,
right.
So we did a complete chemical treatment of the field after a couple of frost, and that's what took care of the Japanese honeysuckle. The blackberries, which are native, but will completely dominate a prairie if you let them go. A lot of the Johnson grass. But anyway, it's an art to trying to time chemical applications to affect things you don't want, but not affect things you do want.
So, as a master gardener, or do you have an interest in having others come to see this property that you're working on?
We do. We don't mind showing people around, and we've done some. We've been on a secret garden tour a couple of times in Murfreesboro.
I got it.
We've had classes out there to get people to walk through to see some ecological restoration at work. So we enjoy showing people. And I enjoy seeing other people's gardens like yours, Mark.
We had a fun time walking around our garden here just before we got started today.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, well, thank you. We don't have as much space as you, but we're trying to do some of the same things.
Now, a lot of space isn't always a good thing necessarily. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of ground to cover.
You know, it's interesting. This company, Invasive Plant Control,
yes,
that you talked about, I know that they're involved with the folks at Warner Park,
mm-hmm,
really on a larger scale, trying to eliminate the privet hedge and the, mm-hmm, stuff that they've got growing out there. But what a monstrous task to take on that 2,500 acre park.
Right, that's amazing. And those guys are good at what they do. They know what they're doing. They do it for federal and state agencies across the country. So it's a monumental undertaking.
It's fantastic. You know, have you been to visit the Seven Islands State Birding Park up near Knoxville?
I have not, but I've been reading about that. It's funny you had mentioned that. It sounds like a place to go.
Well, you just, because of what you just described, it came to mind. And it's quite an interesting place. It's along the French Broad River,
mm-hmm,
just to the east of Knoxville.
Mm-hmm.
Very close to where the Holston and the French Broad come together to make the Tennessee River.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful sight. But it was a dairy farm. And they decided, well, we want to convert this into a place for birds to make a giant meadow. So it's a several hundred acre park. But when they got there, it was all in fescue grass. And the fescue, of course, is a European origin grass.
Mm-hmm.
It has really no wildlife benefit.
It's just too dense.
You know, bobwhite quail,
right,
or anything,
right,
like that you might want to have be there. So the first thing they did with, you know, in a scientific approach was, mm-hmm, to go through and eradicate, mm-hmm, the fescue. And like you described, they've gone in and restored it with native type grassland species,
mm-hmm,
riparian type species.
Yeah.
And it's a terrific park. A lot of the landscape is 6 foot tall native grasses, but for the bird, if you're a birder,
yeah,
man, it's just an idyllic place.
Going to have to make a trip. That sounds
well. Amazing. You should, and I, and listeners also should go out and explore that park.
Right.
Well, Reggie, it's been a thrill to talk with you today. Learned so much about you. Just talking with you, I had no idea that you had been a pilot. Do you still fly?
No, I don't. I miss that, and I just you have to stay at it.
Of course. Of course.
That's in the past.
Well, we all have those things that we've done in our lives, but thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a special fun to have you here.
It's been fun, Mark, and I really appreciate what you're doing with your podcast and your emphasis on conservation and the park employees and park work and the legacy. It's really nice to get this stuff documented and down on paper.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. That's what we're trying to do.
Appreciate it so much.